So for all the episodes and all the crazy stuff that's happened in Breaking Bad so far while we've been doing this podcast, has there been an episode to this point where you just didn't really want to talk about
it? I don't know if there's been like a whole episode, but there have certainly been moments. So I was really dreading talking about Peekaboo, for example. Mm-hmm. I find that one really, really hard to watch. And then probably this one.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's really the point here, is that this is tough. I mean, this is a very difficult episode for a lot of different reasons, you know what I mean? It's not just about how we feel about Walt. There's a lot of other stuff that goes on here that's very difficult to kind of absorb. And it's also one that, you know, I don't want to talk about it, but I also, it has that duality of like, I can't wait to talk about it. Like, I almost feel like I need to talk about it so that I can sort of, you know, be okay with it. And that's really great TV.
That's right. Daddy did that.
Welcome to Growth Decay Transformation, a Breaking Bad rewatch podcast. I'm Pete.
And I'm Courtney.
And today we'll be talking about Season 2, Episode 12, Phoenix, which is an interesting title. It is the name of the Mars rover that discovered water that they're talking about in the bar whenever Walt meets Donald. But then there's probably some other stuff going on, and I think we'll probably get into that. But can you possibly give us a synopsis of everything that happens here?
Well, TLDR, Jane dies, right? And that's that is what this episode is most remembered for. But there is a lot that does go on in this one. So it picks up right where the previous one left off, Mandala, with Walt rushing to the meeting spot to make this deal that he has arranged with Gus. When he finally gets to the hospital, because remember, you know, Skyler's in labor, he finds Skyler, Holly, and Ted in the room. Ted leaves and Skyler asks Walt if he'll go get her overnight bag from home. And when he goes home, he takes that opportunity to hide all of the money he just made from this deal in the garage. At Jesse's, Jane is woken up by a call from her dad, and she tells Jesse that someone broke in. So Jesse gets up and he discovers that the meth has been taken from under the sink where he had hid it, and he panics. He calls the White House and Junior answers at first, and then Walt comes out and he's able to get the phone on the second ring. And Jesse explains to Walt that they'd been robbed, but Walt just hangs up on him. Meanwhile, Jane attends a meeting with her dad and nervously flips her 18-month chip in her hands. Then they go to a coffee shop and she evades all of the questions he has about whether she's seen that guy next door, why her eyes are red, etc.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, Jesse shows up at the school and confronts Walt about taking the money. They argue and Walt says Jesse can't have his share until he's clean and asks him for a urine sample. Enraged by this, Jesse throws the glassware at Walt and it smashes on the blackboard behind him.
You know, this is like, I'm listening to you retell this and I'm getting some feelings about some of these things already. Like, you know, the idea of Walt, I mean, obviously Walt does a lot of stuff here, but man, the way that he talks to Jesse again, like, I know we kind of beat this idea, you know, it's like beating a dead horse a little bit, but some of the stuff he says here is just absolutely rough. And I'm looking forward to getting into some of those moments that you're talking about here.
Yeah, and we'll definitely get more into this, but I think some of the dialogue between Jesse and Walt in a lot of ways mirrors the dialogue or the conversations between Donald and Jane, right? So there's this sort of tough love mm-hmm. approach, but in Walt's case, it's highly hypocritical, but yeah, we'll get into that. So anyway, Walt Jr. puts together SaveWalterWhite.com to raise money to help pay for Walt's surgery, but the idea of accepting charity is absolutely abhorrent to Walt. And he then later complains to Saul that he cannot stand the idea of having all this money on hand and not being able to share it with his family. Saul advises that they use zombies to donate to Junior's website, which will also help them launder Walt's money.
Mm-hmm. Not a bad idea.
Back at Jesse's, Jesse shares with Jane how much money Walt owes him as he's shooting up. The next morning, Donald, Jane's dad, attends the meeting without Jane. Again, she is woken up by his phone call asking her where she is, and as she gets up and rushes out the front door, there he is standing out front, and he confronts her. He rushes into Jesse's, tries to throw Jesse out, and then threatens to call the cops until Jane promises that she will go to rehab. After she explains that she needs a day to be able to call into work and take care of other matters, he agrees to let her wait to go to rehab until the next morning. Big mistake.
Mm-hmm.
After Donald leaves, Jane calls Walt and demands that he give Jesse the money or she will, quote, burn him to the ground. Later that night, Skylar asks Walt to go out to get diapers. He takes that opportunity to go and bring Jesse the money, and Jesse promises Walt that he will never see either of them again. After Walt leaves, Jesse and Jane talk really excitedly about their future and come up with this plan to move to New Zealand. She'll paint, he'll be a bush pilot. And they agree that they're not going to waste all their money on heroin, though, that they're going to get clean and they'll flush what drugs they have left. But we see them walk into the bedroom and then they pause, you know, right in front of the drugs looking down at it. So Walt stops in at a bar where, guess who's there? Don Margolis. He just happens to be in the same bar, mm-hmm. right? So Walt calls Skylar to let her know that he's still looking for these diapers. And then once he gets off the phone, Donald, says, well played. And then they start chatting about daughters and about family. And after Donald hints at the fact that he has a troubled daughter, Walt shares that he has a troubled nephew. Donald tells him, you can't give up on them, which prompts Walt to return to Jesse's after he leaves the bar. He breaks in through the back door and he finds them both unconscious, obviously high. As he tries to rouse Jesse, Jane is knocked onto her back and she starts aspirating on her own vomit, and Walt jumps up and rushes over to her but stops himself from saving her.
Yep, it's that moment. It's that moment we'll come back around to. As far as overall impressions, as I mentioned at the beginning, it's a difficult episode for a lot of reasons. Also, probably the best example of what the show is capable of up to this point. There's been a lot of great episodes. We've talked about all of them. This one, though, it really kind of, I mean, it's a penultimate episode of the season. It sets up, the next phase again for where they go from here. It just gives us a point, like another one of those points, saying a point of no return. It makes it sound like it's an individual. It's sort of that thing of like, when did Jimmy McGill turn into Saul Goodman, right? But there mm-hmm. are all these points, and this is one of the biggest ones and one of the ones that always comes up, in the argument about whether Walt is a likable, if not flawed, anti-hero, or if he is the villain of the story, right? And this, on rewatch, it doesn't get that much easier to parse. I mean, I'm of course he's a villain. That's the side I land on. But, I mean, his motivations aren't purely evil. Like, they're not, like, you see how the character gets to the place where he does these things, and he still has some sympathy. You still see him in a sympathetic light, even when he's just doing awful things. So it's much more complicated, and that's why we're still talking about it all these years later. So what about you? What were your overall impressions for this one?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with everything you just said. And this final scene is probably the most talked about and debated scene in the whole series, or, at least in the top five for sure. And it's a scene I think that we all know incredibly well, even if you've only ever seen Breaking Bad once, this is something that really leaves like a huge impression on you. So
Can I interrupt you real quick? I mean, I agree, like everything you're saying, and I just wanted to ask you a question of the first time you watched it, do you think that you took in all of what was going on through Walt's? I mean, it's a quick scene. It's not like this long drawn out thing. You know what I mean? And I think that you're going to talk about what Bryan Cranston does here. And I think it is absolutely incredible. But the first time you watched it, can you remember what you thought about, like, as far as what Walt was doing in that moment? Or does it almost happen so fast that you really have to go back and think about it again after the fact?
Well, my first time watching it, I was just shocked at what happened.
I think that's the natural thing, right?
Yeah, I was in a state of shock, and it's kind of hard for me to really think back at what point I really saw Walt as a, you know, the bad guy, as the villain of the show. Because I think probably my first watch, I was still seeing things very much from his point of view, mm-hmm. and I think that really is credit to Bryan Cranston's acting here. It's not a scene that really gets any easier watching. And actually, I think it gets harder. At least it was for me. I actually mm-hmm. had a really, really hard time sitting through this one. And I teared up when I watched it last night. And I do think this is the first time that it ever actually moved me to tears. And that was surprising, that I was mm-hmm. so deeply affected by it when I know it so well. This is, you know, certainly not my first time watching. So it's, I don't know. I remember watching it the first time and just being shocked at the events that he allowed her to die. And I think if you hadn't noticed all the more subtle changes in the character, then this is really the confirmation that something has gone wrong here, that he is a changed man. Mm-hmm. But he plays it in such a way, as you were saying, Pete, like you can, like the character rationalize, like, well, what other choices did he have? You know, he was maybe choosing like the lesser of two evils, like let Jane die, save Jesse. But, you know, and I think that's something they talked about on the Insider podcast, was that they want people to debate this. They don't want it to be a clear cut answer, like Walt mm-hmm. is purely evil or whatever, or, you know, like to really debate and think about what is motivating this character, what is driving this character. But what he's done is just so awful and so unforgivable, but he plays it with such emotion and such depth of feeling and that teardrop, really, you almost think that Walt isn't really as awful as his actions may betray him to be. And sorry if you can hear the fireworks in the background. My neighborhood is enthusiastic about 4th of July, so
the, I guess you have leftover fireworks whenever that happens, right? Like I think the actual 4th of July spirit is gone, but maybe there's just fireworks still around that have to be used up or something like that.
I think I just live in a neighborhood full of pyromaniacs. So they start like any a week excuse. Before any holiday, and it goes on for a week after. So 4th of July and New Year's Eve in particular are really unpleasant. There's another one. Yeah. They're really unpleasant times of the year, especially for all my pets. So,
yeah, I think it'll be okay as far as what we're doing here. The tier, you brought up the tier, and you talked about getting a little teary yourself with this. There were two points, and I don't want to actually go into these at this point. I just wanted to respond to what you said. There were two points where I felt that here, and it wasn't this last scene. It was when Jane says, "Daddy, please." That was a really tough one for me this time. I definitely got misty there. And then when Walt was listening to the baby monitor. And and that one sets this one up so well, you know what I mean? That's such a good way to construct that, is that on the one end you're watching a guy who loves his daughter, that he missed her birth and he does feel genuine shame and regret about that. And then the second one, he's watching something that he could prevent and he's choosing inaction. And in his mind, you know, he kind of thinks that that's all the same thing, right? That he's doing this in a way to protect that daughter that was just born. So let's go back to the beginning and let's talk about that. I mean, I guess we could talk about the scene at the abandoned motel, but what I'm thinking about right now is the way that Ted pops into that very intimate moment in the hospital whenever he goes to meet Holly for the first time.
Yeah.
It's just such a great setup shot, the way that Ted is, he's there, you know, everything is, it's all screwed up, but he got there, everything's fine, he's got this beautiful baby in his hand or whatever, and then it's just like, oh, there's Ted Beneke standing there. I didn't notice you there, Ted.
Yeah, there are a few interesting reveals in this episode. So certainly that one, how Walt walks in and he's, you know, holding Holly, and then you see Ted there and you find out that Ted was the one that was where Walt should have been the whole time. He should have been the one driving his wife to the hospital. Mm-hmm. He should have been, you know, there for the birth and everything. And, you know, it's, and then the other reveal of Donald being in that bar when the camera pulls back and,
yeah,
you know, something's going to go down there too. Uh-huh. So I think in both cases, it shows how like estranged Walt is from, you know, everything that's not happening within like his own immediate interests. So he's prioritized this drug deal and getting this thing done, and he's lost sight of everything that's important to him. And I know I'm sort of skipping ahead, but I keep thinking of that bar scene, right? And how like he totally misconstrues and takes out of context what what Donald says to him. And I guess I probably should have included this in my impressions, because it was something that really did stand out to me this time watching, was how like Walt isn't there for his daughter's birth, and yet he thinks, you know, he's able to convince himself that he's doing this for his family, he did this for his daughter, yada yada yada. But it isn't until Donald says like, you can't give up on your family, you know, you have to be there for them, sort of thing, that motivates him to go and try to interfere with Jesse and help Jesse. And how like he prioritizes that relationship over the relationship with his real family, I thought was really interesting in this one. I mean, of course, like is this really in Jesse's best interests? I mean, he lets his partner die. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those things though. Like, what is the lesser of the two evils there?
Yeah, I mean, that's the perfect encapsulation of why it's so complicated, because Walt's not wrong in a way of going over there to see him, you know, to try to intervene, but he's not doing that for his what he ends up doing kind of shows that he's not doing it for Jesse. He's doing it for himself. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea is like, if you want Jesse to be healthy and get, you know, have a life after this moment, having someone that he cares about die next to him is not the way you go about doing that, right? Like, it's, yes, she's trouble. She could be trouble down the road for him, but like, you know, her death is going to be something that he feels responsible for, you know? So pretty tough stuff. But, I mentioned they do the, you know, the deal kind of happens off screen. He is able to get that money. And then there's this, whenever they go back to the, you know, whenever they have this, this Los Pollos, chicken feast at the house, you know, he starts to get the idea that just getting this money is not the only thing that matters, because what good is going through all this stuff if nobody realizes what he's accomplished and how he's pulled this off for the family, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is you know, of course, that's a huge part of who this character is. But I think, like, whenever you think back on this and you think about what happens in this episode, there's a ton of setup for it that maybe I didn't, you know, think about every time when I thought about the way this episode developed. Him saying, you know, we need to think about what's best for the baby, you know, saying it out loud in front of his family, and the conflict that creates inside of him, because he thinks that he does want to do that stuff, but he also wants to be recognized for doing that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he wants his family to know that, you know, what he's gone through and what he's done for them. And those two things both can't be true in the current state of things.
the ego, Walt's ego is, I think, really revealed here. Certainly it's been hinted at previously, but the way that that conversation he has with Saul and trying to think about how he can get this money to his family, and the idea, though, that it be filtered through this website, this idea of charity. And then I also think of that conversation he had with Skylar, where he's like, we can't accept charity. And she's like, why do you say that? Like, that's such a bad thing. And it's really a point of pride with him. He just cannot stomach the idea that anyone else get credit for providing for his family when it was his labor and his work that went into it. So I don't know. The more I think about it now, the more I'm like, you know what? This guy's just, he's such an asshole. And everything that is motivating him is selfish. And so, yes, that scene with Jane there, where we see that play of emotions across his face. And, but that could just be like normal human impulse, normal human reaction. I don't know how much we could be like, oh, Walt actually cares or whatever, because I don't think he actually does. I don't think he really feels any remorse about what happens with Jane until maybe he's really high on the sleeping pills and the fly, you know? I don't know. I mean, he seems to be completely at peace with what he does.
Yeah, I think that in the moment he does feel something. I think he just has a way of telling himself that, and I don't think this is unique to Walter White either. I think this is anybody that finds themselves going through something like this, is that there's a dissonance, right? So you have to make that, you have to either it consumes you and, you know, you change something or you do something, or you figure out a way to make it make sense. And then you just go with that. Right. And there's a lot of angry people walking around out in the world that are, you know, kind of are really hard to deal with and just sort of make things, you know, uncomfortable because of the fact that they're doing that. Right. Like, it's a pretty human response to like, I don't understand. I don't know what to do with this. I don't know what to do with the idea that I did this thing. And so, I'm just going to keep going and pretend like it didn't happen, and then try to convince myself that it was the right thing to do. There was only so many choices, and the one I picked has to be the right one because that's the one I picked. Right.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of his rationalization and his compartmentalization that he does. I keep getting us off track a little bit here. There's just, because it's all things lead back to that scene with Jane, right? But the question that you opened with, right, about like what's best for the baby. Of course, there's a huge irony there that Walt would even deign to, you know, like pretend like he really has like the baby's best interest in mind when he's out there, you know, doing all these things behind the scenes. That's certainly not in the best interest of his family. Now, you might be someone that's like, oh, well, he's providing for his family, he's getting money for his family, but, you know, he's putting them at great risk by doing this, you know, by working with drug dealers and the threat of violence. You know,
and look
the
at how much of the actual money has made it to his family.
Exactly.
At this point.
Yeah.
You know? Like he, you know, if that's really what he was doing, like maybe he needs to try to think of a different direction to go. I mean, I guess, especially now he's going to have this surgery. That's the plan. You know, he's in remission. Like he's not in the same place he was where he had to like try to do this overnight.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, and we talked about this in the last one, right? So deciding to go ahead with this deal with Gus was purely selfishly motivated. I don't think he can keep making that case that it's for the family when he did actually have other options. So he could have opted not to have the surgery and then just sold off what he could in whatever way that, you know, he and Jesse could have managed without making this deal.
Absolutely. And speaking of Jesse, there's this, in the early part of the episode, you know, there's this oversleeping, right? He sleeps through Walt coming into the apartment the night before, and Jane sleeps through this meeting that she's supposed to go to and meet her father. And you figure by this point, you know, 18 months, you know, her chip says 18 months. She's been doing this for a while. This is an established tradition that would set off red flags for her father if she just showed up late, right?
I think so. Maybe once, like, yeah, she overslept and, you know, she was running late. She's in the shower or whatever, but it starts becoming a habit. And I think when that first time she oversleeps and she meets him and then they go and have coffee and breakfast or whatever afterwards, she notices.
She looks a little tweaked out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She looks a little strung out. The eyes are red. She comes up with a story for that. She's working on this tat or whatever, but, you know, he's been through this with her before, obviously. So he uh-huh. knows what to look for. So certainly the second time she oversleeps, I think, you know, he made the right call showing up. Like, he knew something was off.
Right. And I think Walt has been primed for this. Obviously, he's never been okay with Jesse using, but I think his reaction is kind of primed by the interaction with Gus, right? Gus says you can never trust a junkie or a drug addict, however he worded it. So I think that's something that's going on with Walt whenever he tries to do this. I'm going to hold on to your money until you get clean. Because I don't think we've really seen that side of him before. Like, we've seen him talk down to Jesse and generally think that he's less than human at times because of the fact that he uses drugs. But this is, like, I think the first time when we really see him trying to control his drug use, other than when they first made the first batch, right?
I believe so. And I think this is probably worth unpacking a little bit and asking, like, why does Walt suddenly care? And I think what you just said, Pete, you know, this, there's more on the line here, right? There's more at stake. And to make this deal with Gus, and certainly if this is someone that he wants to continue working with in the future, this is someone that doesn't, you know, take kindly to drug use. And it almost cost them the deal, right? Like, I mean, you can probably, at least in Walt's point of view, like, it was his relationship with Jesse that really almost blew it for them. And it did blow it for him until he convinced Gus to give him the second shot, right? You're not uh-huh. a cautious man because you work with this junkie. And so I for the first time, it really does affect Walt's, you know, interests that he is using drugs. So yeah, he cares more now, but it's not as, I don't think it's coming from as selfless as of a place as, like, someone like Donald caring about his daughter using.
Right. Because it did affect him. He has the thing to say, like, I had to miss my daughter's birth. You know what I mean? Which is,
yeah, but
I'm saying, like, from his point of view, right? We were talking about Walt's point of view. He can say that to Jesse, you cost me this thing that I'm never going to get back, which is all BS, you know, like, for sure. Yeah. It was set up the way that it was set up, that he had to be there. So he made that choice. He said, this is more important than seeing my daughter be born. But then also, like, when you look at that big bag of money, this is the biggest bag of money that they've ever seen. And it does look like it justifies all the stuff that happened before it to the person that's looking into that bag for the first time, I think. What do you think about that?
That's a hard question, because knowing everything that they've done, like, is there any amount of money that makes it okay? I mean, for the character, yes.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You know, that's what we're talking about from Walt's point of view, right? Trying to put myself in that position, I don't know that I could answer that.
I mean, as Jesse said, that's a lot of cheddar. You know what I mean? You see the look on Jane's face, like, this is the kind of money that could change. You could be anything anyway. Nobody can tell us what, you know, who to be anymore, right? Nobody can make us do anything. That's what it feels like when you see that. It has to feel that way, right?
I suppose.
I mean, I've never seen it, so this is only a guess. You know what I mean? Like, I've never had a $1.2 million in a bag to look at that was mine, you know, free and clear. But I'm assuming.
Yeah, well, it's only 480 after, you know, Saul takes his 20%. So, I mean, $480,000 is still a significant amount of money, right? But, like, if you know, Jesse and Jane seem to think, like, they're going to be able to, like, you know, go retire in New Zealand or whatever on that. And it certainly would get them out of town, you know, get them out of Dodge, get them, you know, from not having to, like, send her to rehab or whatever, I guess. You know, it's a fresh start for them.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because that's something I want to talk about. I mean, obviously, there is a lot of magical thinking going on with those mm-hmm. two, right? It's not enough money for that. Walt probably is right to a certain extent that they'll just blow it. And they know this. That's why they're so hard trying to say, like, we're not going to do that. We're better than this, right? You don't say that if you don't some part of you doesn't know that that's exactly what's going to happen, right? I mean, they're in addiction, and all that does, having a big bag of money in that situation, is it takes away all of the things that make addiction hard for a period of time, and then it's gone, and then everything's even way worse, I guess, right? So the magical thinking part of it is interesting, because they're on two opposite sides of the spectrum here in the way they're doing that. But you know, you see Walt with the same thing. It's like, I just got to get this money, and then he gets the money, and it's not really fixing anything as far as like what he wants. Like, he does have that security, like that big stack of money's in his laundry room or whatever at the moment. But nobody knows that what he did, and that bothers him, and he can't just go out and spend the money. You know what I mean? And there's like,
yeah, there's the rub, right? Like, it's you just hit the nail on the head there, Pete. It's not about the money; it's about the recognition. And we'll see. Maybe not so much at this point, and certainly not maybe through our first watch through, was this obvious that this is what's driving this man? Is this out of control ego that needs validation, needs recognition? Needs to become the kingpin, the empire, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But that is ultimately what it ends up being for him, that he's chasing this need to be recognized for his greatness.
Mm-hmm. No, I earned that money. Me, you know? Like, yeah. Sounds like a child, but also you kind of see where he's coming from.
You're listening to Growth, Decay, Transformation. We'll be right back.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Let's get cooking. We're back with more Growth Decay Transformation. The idea of charity, is that a real belief of this character that he had going in? I mean, I know he was reluctant to take the money from
Gretchen and Elliot,
but there was some personal reasons involved with that, right? He resented the hell out of them, and he had romantic feelings that were unresolved with Gretchen because of something that he did, and he feels, he feels a certain way about, right? So like when he says charity is, this aversion to charity that he has, is it because he already has that money is it just because he really does believe that charity's wrong or whatever, or is it because he has that stack of money in the laundry room, do you think?
That's an interesting question. And I think it's more his own ideology, like it's his own outlook. And I think there's a uniquely, maybe it's not only something you find in the United States, but it is a sort of uniquely American mentality where this idea of bootstrapping yourself and not accepting help from anyone, and this idea of a hard work and labor. And I mean, you hear stories like when, your older relatives tell you about how they had to walk to school, mm-hmm. 10 miles uphill both ways, in the snow sort of thing. So there's this, I think this American, sentiment, right? That you do things for yourself by yourself. And if you accept charity or handouts, then you're weak or somehow or lesser than. So I think and you could call that a number of things. You might say that's a sort of a toxic masculinity or machismo or something like that. Not to put labels on it, but I do think that there is this prevailing attitude in this society. So yeah. I think that's something that Walt is starting to tap into more and more as he becomes more of this Heisenberg character, this hyper-masculine, ego-driven, even capitalist, right? Trying mm-hmm. to build out his empire. And, we were just talking a minute ago about, is he really driven by the money? What's actually driving him? And I think the best answer we get to that question is when in season 5, when Skylar takes him to the storage place where she's keeping all the money, mm-hmm. and she asks him how big the pile has to get, how much will ever be enough for him. And I mean, there's more money than they can even count. There's more money than they could spend in 10 lifetimes. So it was never about the money for him. It's really all about this ego. What do you think? How would you answer that question?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure. I think it's a little bit of both. I think that you're right. I agree with what you're saying there. I think that is the kind of guy that he is. That's the mindset that he would have been brought up with, and he would have, and he would, he wouldn't want to. I don't know. I guess the reason why I brought it up and I thought about it this time when I was watching was just because it's such a quick and, he really gets upset by the idea of it. And Skylar's there, she's crying, she was moved to tears at this really sweet thing that Junior did. And he recoils, he's really put off by it, and he doesn't really there's not a lot of like, there's not a lot of give in it. And I don't know that it's consistent with that, but I just think that that has to, the money also has to have some influence there. You know what I mean? Because of what we see later. And, you know, even what we see at the pool, or, you know, when they're having the food outside by the pool, you know, it's like, wait a minute. Everybody's talking about not having money, like, and talking about me like I'm not providing or something like that. You know, Skylar's talking about like, oh, I'm going to be back at work soon because I figure you're having this surgery and we're going to need the money. And he sees that, you know, Junior is even thinking about taking a job, and he hates that feeling, right?
I definitely think he does, right? So I think both things could be true, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think they're necessarily mutually exclusive. But, you know, I think with him, like, with what we know of the character and where he's coming from, right? So this is someone that he describes himself even as extremely overqualified when he's talking to that psychiatrist after his fugue state, who, you know, is working, like, in a menial job well below his ability, and that all of his colleagues and friends have surpassed him in every meaningful way. And then, of course, I mean, the gray matter thing is a sore spot for him for a number of reasons. And it's mm-hmm. all wrapped up in whatever history he has with Gretchen and, you know, whatever that means to him about his own masculinity and in his identity. And that is his biggest regret. You know, it was walking away from that business, walking away from that money, walking away from that legacy, as he later tells Jesse, that he sold himself short. And I think that's really what drives him at this point, is to not ever allow himself to become that milquetoast, you know, mm-hmm. High school chemistry teacher who gets laughed at by his students, down on his hands and knees scrubbing tires. Mm-hmm. And now that he has a taste of his power, it's addictive, and that's not something he can really give up.
Yeah, I mean, think about the difference of that scene at the car wash where he's seeing this kid, the same one that acted like an ass in the
Chad.
Room in front of everybody. Yeah. Friggin' Chad.
It's always a Chad.
Yeah, and then think about the end of the episode where he tells them to stay out of his territory. You know, it's two different reactions to the same person. And it's, you know, I mean, there's, of course, there's the idea of the way power corrupts people and things like that. You can't, that, you know, that is all, that there is some real truth to. It's not just characters on TV shows and stuff like that, right? I mean, think about like that one summer job you had where, you know, someone you liked and got along with, they became the manager, and then all of a sudden, you know, the whole dynamic changes, right? So like, yeah, once he's had a taste of that, he can't really go back, can he?
I don't think so. And, you know, certainly I think you kind of alluded to this earlier, Pete. It's like he's so far gone at this point. He's already done so many horrible things that it's in his best interest psychologically, as like a mechanism to protect his psyche, to keep compartmentalizing and keep rationalizing, because any normal person that stopped and actually took stock of what they had done, how would you live with yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how could you keep functioning when you really think about the things that you have done, that the atrocities that he has committed up to this point? So it's really in his psychological best interest not to, and just to keep going. And it's like, he's already gone this far. What's another murder? What's another crime?
Yeah, and this is where it really does veer, where that idea of what we keep going back to about seeing things through his point of view, where things really do start to diverge here. Because if we think about, like, you know, if we compare this, the writers set things up in a way that when he kills Crazy Eight, it's pretty straightforward. It's self-defense, and almost at the point of time it happens, right? You could say that if you found yourself in the, you know, in the same situation, that you would, because he's going to die if he doesn't do it, right? Like, this is here. This is, you know, this is not that case. You know, this is something where he has a choice, and he chooses to let someone die, someone that is someone's daughter, someone that's a human being, someone that has her flaws, and that has been, you know, that definitely came out during this episode, if you hadn't noticed them already. Not someone who's a, you know, like a cipher or something of someone, you know, like the perfect person that just died too soon, a real human being that we can relate to in that way. And he chose to let that happen. And then I think that that's one of the things that's really interesting this time watching it is the way that they otherize each other. Right. Like I mentioned the whenever, because he does have feelings for Jesse, they're complicated. We're not even really sure what they are, I don't think, if we're being honest, but like he does have some protective, you know, he feels protective for him. You know, he does somewhat think of him as almost family. Right. Maybe he hates the fact that that's true, but it happens. And it comes out in all these ugly ways with him, the way that he talks to him. But here we see him for the first time, like really put it on his little junkie girlfriend. And then we see Donald do that same thing whenever he calls Jesse the scumbag. And that's sort of like the kind of way that you have to do it when this person that you care about is going through something that you can't make sense. Right. So like with Walt, this, all of this comes together, you know, like of where he's doing that thing, that human thing of like, well, this person is a threat to me. Jane is a threat to me. So she can't be all those other things because that's the most important thing that she is. And, it's just really, really great, TV, the way this is all set up.
Yeah, definitely great drama. And just to go back to this idea of othering the other, I think that is such a great point that the way that Donald talks about Jesse and the way Walt talks about Jane as being like these negative influences on their person. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Jesse, as far as Donald's concerned, Jesse is what has corrupted his daughter. And then as far as Walt's concerned, Jane is corrupting Jesse. Mm-hmm. And she poses a more imminent threat to him because she has actually threatened to blackmail him. And, you know, knows a lot, right, about what they have done and everything.
She lays it out like, that's one of the things that they're not that subtle about, right? Like she, because mm-hmm. of the fact of the position where she's at, she lays it out that she knows all the things that would bring him down, you know, about Hank,
exactly.
About his job, what he does, the whole nine yards.
Yeah. So she does pose, you know, a serious threat to him. So he has... You know, he has a lot of interest in getting rid of her at, you know, in any way possible. But yeah, to think about Jesse and Walt's relationship, it is such a weird one. And it's something we have talked about before, but it's, you know, it changes, it evolves. It's this really complicated father-son, but also, you know, when I think of how their relationship even started, Walt blackmailed Jesse into working with him. Like, mm-hmm. you either cook with me or I'm going to turn you into the police, right? So he blackmails Jesse in the same way that Jane is now blackmailing mm-hmm. Walt to get what they want, you know, to control the situation. But it is the way that Walt is with Jesse. The first time I watched this confused me a little bit because when they have that conversation later in the bar and he's like, they're family, you can't give up on them. I was like, but Walt, this isn't your actual son. This isn't your kid. Like, I understand you care about him or whatever, but you have a real family that you're neglecting. Mm-hmm. And just another thing I wanted to mention in response to you, Pete, does Walt really have Jesse's best interests in mind? And I mean, you can debate it. You could try to argue either point, play devil's advocate, and you could be like, yes, mm-hmm. like there was a very good likelihood that this would have gone really bad and Jesse would have gone further into his addiction, maybe ended up dead or whatever, like Walt said that he would, you know, he'd be dead within the space of a week or something like that. Mm-hmm. But we don't know that, right? We don't really know that. But we do know that Walt does put himself on the line multiple times for Jesse. So I think of like when, I guess that's the end of, is it like the finale of season 3 when he goes and runs over Gus's guys?
It is in season 3, yeah. I'm not sure if it's I don't think it's the last episode, but I don't remember right now.
Well, whatever. It doesn't matter what episode it is. It's the one where he interferes and he kills the two drug dealers that shot Andrea's little brother. And when Jesse, you know, to stop Jesse from getting killed or whatever, and he tells him to run. So, I mean, like, he does, like, that's also, like, what is he doing? Why would he risk, you know, mm-hmm. anyway, that's a whole other conversation. But yeah. It is a complicated, really complicated relationship that those two have. And I think, you know, that he does care about him in some way. It's toxic. It's terrible. And he does horrible things to him. I mean, he allows the woman he loves to die, you know, knowing that full well is going to torture him. Or maybe he doesn't even think about it.
Yeah, I think you can make the case for him not being in the moment, not thinking that all the way through. Like, if you wanted to give him a more sympathetic read of what he does there, I guess. But like, yeah, I mean, and that's the interesting thing about addiction and using that as Jesse's thing, because we see all of Jesse's stuff, you know what I mean? Because we're watching a TV show that goes on we're seeing all these different facets of his life, of his personality and everything else. When you think about a drug addict, like there's this kind of thing that people do where they're like, if you know, every, you know, people are sick, right? Like if they have something else, it's different. Because when you think about drug addiction, you think, well, they're doing something that makes them feel good, which somehow kind of makes it worse. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. Everybody else is going around trying to make, you know, take care of them and try to fix all the problems they're causing. And they're around sitting there, you know, getting high, which is, you know, people find that very difficult to, I think, make peace with, you know, because they think that it's just selfish in a different kind of way. I wouldn't say that I agree with that necessarily, but you know what I mean? Like that's why it's an interesting thing for him to be dealing with, because like Walt is terrible. You know, he says, you know, when have you not dropped the ball? You know, when, you know, you're never going to be anything. And he's telling him, like, you know, I'm going to hold this money like he's a child and until he can like produce this urine test. And he doesn't really think of that as being like an awful way to be because of the situation, because of addiction. Right.
I think so. And I think there's more to it though. Also, I think he really, at this point, sees Jane as this obstacle, right? That she has all this leverage and this control over Jesse, and Walt really needs to get rid of Jane. So I think, you know, I was, as you were talking, I was, I'm sorry to kind of skip ahead a little bit, but I was thinking about, you know, Walt allowing Jane to die and this question of whether he actually considers Jesse's feelings at all in this, and how actually this puts him in a position that he is the only person Jesse has. And it gets Jesse to come back, crawling back to him. And that's exactly what happens in the next episode. He calls him panicking, crying, and then Walt's able to swoop in and save the day, right? So it's mm-hmm. another way of regaining control over Jesse and getting rid of this obstacle that's in the way there.
Yeah, it was one of the toughest parts of this early in the episode was when he just doesn't say anything to him on the phone when he realizes what happened. You know, like Jesse's calling and he's so worried and he says, what was the line that he said?
Yell at me.
Yeah. Say something, man. All right. Yell at me or something. Right. You know, because he's so freaking out about not knowing where the drugs were because he doesn't remember telling Walt where they were the night before, whenever he was in bed. And that was just like one of the ones like where he just hangs up on him. I'm just like, okay, they show the answering machine flashing after that, you know, that he'll probably put it together. But like, what a shitty way to be, you know, to just be like, oh, okay, I figured it out. So I'm not going to say another word. I'm just going to hang up on you because how dare you call me on this line with my family nearby and all that other stuff that goes on every time they kind of have a conversation on that phone.
And from Walt's point of view, he really is pissed off at Jesse. He really does blame Jesse for, you know, not being able to be there for his daughter's birth and for almost this deal almost falling through, right? Because he had to rush over. Jesse wasn't answering his phone. He was unconscious, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, you already kind of broached this a little bit already, right? Like, it's not really accurate that it's Jesse's fault that he missed the birth of his daughter, because Walt absolutely made that choice for himself. That was something he did. But of course, he blames Jesse for it. But it's not Jesse's fault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess that kind of goes back to a little bit of what I was saying about the addiction and the way that you look at those characters, you know, because Walt's making the exact same choices. He's behaving as an addict, but he doesn't have the, you know, his drug is something that generally people consider to be a good instinct. You know what I mean? Like what you were saying earlier, like he's collecting money. He's being successful in a certain way. You know, obviously he's doing it illegally and everything else, but like it you know, accumulating money and making bad choices is like something you can be like, yeah, that's okay. You know what I mean? Like, of course I wish I would have done that a little bit better, but whatever, you know, like it doesn't seem as, indulgent as someone who's, you know, using drugs all the time or whatever. Another thing I was thinking about when I was watching this, you know, like I said, the one that really got me misty eyed was the when she says "Daddy, please," because it's not that she says that necessarily. It's the whole dynamic of like, this is like her last card that she knows that she can play because she is his little girl, right? Like, it's the, you know, it's not she's like blatantly playing, like trying to pull his heartstrings, right? Like, so
yeah.
And you know why she's doing it, right? Like, it's a survival situation for her, right? Like, she's not evil in that moment either. She's like really trying to figure something out because she's caught, right? She's in, and like I said, it's kind of like whenever you have an addiction like what they have here, you know, like we're assuming that she has a long history of heroin addiction, right? At least I am. So I would say that in her position, like she, for her, like her, it's sort of like survival, but the hierarchy of needs has been altered, right? Like the first thing you have to do is protect your addiction, and then everything else will fall into place. That's just sort of the way that it rearranges things. And so, like, you know, when she's saying that, she's trying to get high one more time, but she's not telling herself, I want to get high one more time before I go to rehab. She's saying like, you know, I need to take back control for this minute so I can figure it out. And then I will do the right thing when I get a chance. Right.
Well, I think they're put in a more urgent situation because he's, remember, dialing the police and he actually has them on the line. So she's going to say whatever, you know, he wants to hear, whatever she has to say to stop that from happening, right?
Yeah,
she doesn't want the police to get involved. So, you know, they're both her and Jesse are now at risk of being arrested because he wants, you know, he even says like, maybe this is what it takes, letting you dry out, you know, in a jail cell or something. So, but it is one of those scenes, and Kristen plays it so great.
Mm-hmm.
The way that she raises her voice like a couple of octaves and talks to him, that you can imagine probably how she spoke to him when she was a little girl sort of thing. And they're like, but daddy, and, you know, last time I went to rehab, all my houseplants died because you didn't water them, you know?
Yeah.
And she's really, she knows exactly what to say to him and to convince him. And, you know, I'm sure it's heartbreaking knowing what happens to her, of course. And I feel so bad for Donald in that scene because, you know, for the rest of his very short life after all this happens, that scene must play over and over in his head. You know, why didn't I call the cops? Why didn't I make her go to rehab that day? You know, it's a brutal episode.
It's a classic situation where there's really no right choice for him. He sort of knows that he doesn't put it all together in the moment, but like, because of the way things played out, like you just pointed out, then it always feels like he did the wrong thing, you know, even though what he did at the time was he chose to love his daughter and hope that she would be okay. You know what I mean? For another 24 hours. And, it's so brutal whenever Jesse says, did you mean all that? Because I think in his mind, he was sort of like wanting her to mean all that too. Right. And then she says, I don't know. I just think if we had enough money or whatever she says, you know, that we could do whatever we want. And, no one can make us do anything. That's what it is. Yeah. And that's brutal as well.
Yeah. And it's not the first time that Jesse's been sort of flummoxed by her, you know? So like the first encounter with her dad, where he wanted her to introduce him. And then he was like, when she comes back later and he's like, you know, what was that? Why do you act like you didn't know me? And how she plays it off there. So I think he has a hard time reading her too. You know, she's something of an enigma to Jesse. So I don't know if he really wanted, I mean,
I don't know if Jesse can really trust her either, because like there's another shot in this where she's, whenever they're talking about New Zealand, you know, New Zealand is New Zealand, and they start to hug and, and she says, I don't care where we go as long as we're together. And you're like, really? You know, like, is it him or that bag of money? Because up until now, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know that you got to a place where you're the most important thing in the world is to spend the rest of your life with this guy next door. It seems like it's skipping a couple of steps there, but I'm not sure. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And I think it goes back to what you were saying about addiction. And I think her attitude about Jesse is, she knows he's someone that's not good for her, obviously. And she knows that from day one. She knows that he's someone that she should probably be avoiding, but she's attracted to him. And we've spoken about like how it's probably because she relates to him. She identifies with, you know, his lot in life sort of thing, like how his family treats him and how she sees herself perhaps. And I think some of the things that she says, I don't know that she actually believes the things she says. Like when she, you know, tells Jesse that, you know, when they have that first argument after she doesn't introduce him to her dad, and she's like, what am I supposed to tell him, that like I'm sleeping with the guy next door, and by the way, he's a drug dealer, or whatever she says, you know? I don't know that she really carries that own judgment within herself as much as she's just like parroting what she hears sort of thing. And I think of the conversation she had with her dad at the coffee shop in this episode, or the first meeting they go to. And she's like, he's our tenant. Why would I sleep with the tenant? You know? So I think she's just telling him what she thinks he wants to hear, or what sounds like the rational, logical thing. I think she's conflicted. Let me say that. I think she's a conflicted character, and she is both attracted and repulsed.
Yeah.
By Jesse. And that repulsion probably has more to do with like how she feels about herself more than it does about him.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I remember we kind of got into that a little bit when we were talking about that episode. And it was more about her, was the way that she was acting that way. But we also talked about the fact that, you know, she looks down on him. Like, she thinks he's you know, not too smart, and she's attracted to him and she likes him. I'm not saying that none of that is true, you know what I mean? But also she has that thing of like, is he really good enough? Because he's kind of, you know, he draws Kanga man and you know, it's obviously a female kangaroo, that kind of thing, you know? So the one thing, I guess, so when we're talking about that, then do you think that there's any of that in Walt's relationship with Jesse? Like, you know, because he obviously thinks he's his intellectual superior, and he is, I mean, for all intents and purposes. Do you think that that's part of why he has such a hard time with Jesse too, is that he can't really figure out why he cares so much for him?
Could be.
I mean, I don't know how we could ever actually, you know, where we could say one way or another if it's true or not. But I do wonder about it now, just because that's a strange part of that. I that really stood out to me watching when she says, I don't care where it is as long as it's with you, because that just doesn't, none of what we've seen between them so far made that make sense about that being, you know, true. It was more about like, this is what we need to have happen, because this awful thing is in, you know, my dad was just in here wanting to beat you up, and you know, he's going to make me go to rehab, and all those complicated situations that are all happening at the same time.
I think Jesse is a really good hype man. And I guess I'm thinking of that Lizzo song, that I'm going to need a sentimental man or lady to pump me up. And I think Walt and to some extent Jane like Jesse because of how he makes them feel about themselves. So right. Walt, when he first gets into this relationship with Jesse, this partnership, is not respected by anyone. And Jesse thinks he's this genius. He thinks he's this like great artist, you know, and that he's just, you know, he can kind of do no wrong. This guy is just amazing. The smartest guy he knows. And of course they have their trouble and their disagreements, and Jesse calls him a bitch every now and then, but he respects Walt. He really does. He has a lot of respect for this guy, and that eventually turns into fear more than anything. But I think, you know, with Jane as well, she's flattered by Jesse's attention, you know, and Jesse is a sweet kid, you know, like, I think he's someone that, like, you know, if it weren't for all the drugs and stuff like that, like, he's someone like that would be a good friend to you, that would give you the shirt off his back sort of thing. Like, that's just the sense you get
that.
From him, so.
I think you would pick up on that pretty quickly with him.
Yeah. So when it comes to Walt, I think why is Walt so invested in Jesse? I have so many different theories about this. You know, I really do think he thinks of him as a son, and maybe in some ways it's like the relationship that he wishes he could have with his own son that he can't. And of course he can't share with Junior what he does with Jesse. Like, he's not going to take his 16-year-old son and start cooking meth with him, right? But to have that sort of closeness and to be able to share that knowledge and pass on that those skills, right? So Jesse may not know all the terminology, or, you know, like, he's not like a PhD in chemistry, in other words, but he's a good chemist. And that's something that he'll prove over and over again. After Walt, he's probably the best meth chemist in the world, right?
According to the show's lore, that's what I've been led to believe, for sure. You know, when he goes down to Mexico eventually, those guys were better educated than him, and he outdid them in his process. So,
yeah. So Jesse's his protege, right? So he's part of his legacy.
And he pays his rent, so he has civil rights, huh? I mean,
yeah. I know my rights, bitch.
The reason why I wanted to bring that up was because I had mentioned this line a couple of times where he says, this scumbag, this loser, whenever he's pointing the finger at him. But I love the follow-up there. It takes one to know one. And, you know, like, we talked about this a little bit before we started the episode, but I was always under the impression when I watched this that Donald was in treatment too. That's why they were in the meeting together. And I was fascinated to find out that your take was that he was just there in a supportive role. So yeah, that's one of the things that I just assumed, I guess, because I saw them in that meeting together, that he understood what she was going through because he went through it himself. And I always wondered about him having the beer there, and if that meant that he, you know, this current situation meant that he was having a relapse of his own and all that kind of stuff. And it actually works a little bit better if it's the way that you mentioned, that he was just there in a supportive role, because I'm not sure, maybe if he's hardcore, if he had himself gotten sober and gotten clean and had insight into how difficult that process is, I'm not sure if he waits until the next morning to let her go to rehab and just leaves her there so that he can go off and have a beer and meet Walt in a bar or whatever, you know?
Yeah, it never even occurred to me that he himself was an addict of any kind. I always just assumed he was there in a supportive role, you know, and to ensure that she was actually going to her meetings. Mm-hmm. I mean, he babysits her, essentially, and he's, and I'm sure that comes from their history, you know, and the few scenes that we get of them together, you get this idea that he really is sort of overbearing, like he's like constantly prying into her life, like, you know, you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be doing that, I wish you wouldn't work here, you shouldn't be around these people, you know, and asking her about her love life. And I mean, those are all really innocent questions that you could imagine a parent and their adult child having, like, normally.
Yeah, but, and her, obviously, in his point of view is that he's doing all that, it's all helpful, you know, like that he's doing that to be supportive and helpful, but it doesn't have that effect from her point of view, obviously.
Yeah. And certainly now that she has things to hide, right? Like, she doesn't want him to know that she's sleeping with Jesse or that she's back on drugs, obviously. So, I just always got the sense that this is someone who went through a really tough time with his daughter, and he's doing what he can to ensure that she stays on track.
Don't forget your pants. We'll be back right after this short break.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character Furiosa, starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role and the mighty Thor Chris Hemsworth as the warlord Dr. Dementis. Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com.
Fire up the RV. We're back with more Growth, Decay, Transformation.
And so to go back to that bar conversation again, I mean, a lot's been said about the coincidence of them ending up in the same place. I know in the Insider podcast, Vince brought up that point that you brought up in one of our first episodes, but that coincidences aren't bad he's okay with coincidences if they're not bad for the.
No, only if coincidences are okay, only as long as they are bad for the characters.
Right.
Like, it can never be a coincidence that actually suits the characters. And so on the surface, I think this one looks like, hey, like, this is a coincidence because it is the motivating factor that leads Walt to go back to Jesse's. And then he solves this problem of Jane. But ultimately, it's not solving the problem, I think, is the point that Vince Gilligan was hoping to make, right? Like, this is actually a really terrible, awful thing that happens. Mm-hmm. Even though on the surface it seems to further Walt's interests, at least in the short term.
So he goes back to the duplex and he is he's going to try to have a conversation with Jesse and try to get him. He's going to try to be a dad, right? Like, he's going to, that's the point, is to be supportive.
Talk sense to him. Yeah.
Right. And it's pretty hard to imagine that, you know, like in a different way that played out, like where Jesse is not unconscious and he does actually talk to him. You know, it doesn't really matter because it wasn't meant to be. But I think that also plays into setting up why you have, like, why when you see that conflict in his face, whenever that it's all going down, that you're a little bit primed to feel sympathetic for Walt, even though he's doing a horrible thing.
Definitely. We're meant to see it from his point of view. And I think that's something that I need to constantly remind myself of, is that we're seeing this very much from Walt's point of view. And, just always remember that and to also consider, like, how the other characters are affected and how they might feel in these episodes, because we're, again, so aligned with his point of view.
Well, I agree with that. We jumped all around and we always kept ending up back at this same place.
Yeah.
Were there some other things in the episode that we didn't touch on that you wanted to go back to?
I think we pretty much covered everything worth covering in this one. I mean, because that is the really big moment. And they do some really fun, like, little foreshadowing things. I think it's all common knowledge by this point, but certainly, like, how, like, when Walt goes to put Holly in her crib and he's with Marie and yeah. he shows her how to, like, put her on her side. And then when Jesse and Jane are shooting up and that's when he tells her about how much money he's owed, she's like, not on your back, baby. Get on your side sort of thing. I think all of that is nicely, you know, put together. So it leads up to this really, really awful ending. And can I just say that John Scheiben is so good at writing, like, really gut-wrenching episodes. So not just in Breaking Bad, but in The X-Files, do you remember all the episodes with Scully's, like, cancer arc, like where she gets diagnosed with cancer?
I can't say that I do.
Okay, so he wrote a lot of those, like, X-Files fans out there, he wrote Memento Mori. Yes, this is that guy. And he also wrote two of, like, the most difficult X-Files episodes to watch, called Emily and Christmas Carol, that are just brutal. I think just absolutely gut-wrenching. So I actually went to go look up to remind myself of what episodes he was responsible for. I'm like, this computes. Yes, this is definitely on brand for John Scheiben. He has a way of writing really, really, really difficult episodes.
He was saying that he, in the Insider podcast, he was saying that he had used his son, when his son was like really young, like 6 weeks old or something like that, as a baby on the X-Files.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he played Baby William.
And that he then, whenever he showed that to him after he grew up, and, you know, a bit, and he said, you know, he wanted to be famous again. He's actually the young Jesse in one of those webisodes that they made, where you see a little bit of what Jesse looked like when he's a little kid. It's his. Yeah, I wondered about that. I was going to ask you if you were familiar with which episodes he wrote in X-Files, because it was obvious in their conversation that with Vince, they had a very close working relationship from their time on the X-Files. And I guess he wasn't available when season one was together. So that Vince seemed very happy to have him here for season two. And yeah, I mean, this is a really great episode. There's really nothing here that feels like it. I mean, from the beginning to the end, it just feels like every single piece fits perfectly. And it plays to this last crushing situation so perfectly. And it also makes you think about everything that came before it too. You know what I mean? Like, I was, you know, a couple of weeks ago, whenever we were talking, I was saying that the one episode wasn't my favorite episode. And that's part of the reason why, is because of this, you know what I mean? Because this episode is so good. And it's only in comparison where one is less than the other. But, like, everything that happened in that one is so essential to what we see here and why we react to it the way that we do.
You know, you mentioned earlier as, like, this being, like, the penultimate episode. And this, I think, is such a well-done episode that it might explain why a lot of the fans that were disappointed with the big reveal in the finale of ABQ, like what the black and white scenes meant and everything, this really ups the ante, this episode does. And it's like, how are they possibly going to top this in terms of, like, you know, story and emotion and things like that? So I can, you know, I was thinking about it when I was watching it yesterday, because that's something you've brought up before, Pete, like that a lot of people were really, really disappointed in how this season ended and what the big reveal was. And I think after watching this one, I'm like, I get it now. I can understand, like, why the next one would feel like something of a letdown for some people.
Yeah, because it's an incredibly tense episode of TV that we're about to watch next week. I mean, it's if you just think about it on its own, it's an incredible episode of TV too. But it's a 1-2 punch, and it's that whole setup is, like, if you think about it, like, if you were watching it in real time as this episode's going on, and you really have that on your brain, like, who are those body bags that we saw a couple episodes back next to the Aztec? You have to be thinking, like, it's Jane and Jesse at that point or something like that, right? You know what I mean? Or it's, you know, something that Jane is going to do is going to lead to that. And then it's a big surprise when then, you know, she's off the table by the end of the episode.
Oh, definitely. And I think when I watched this this for the first time, this episode, because I was starting to think of like, what are those two bodies going to be? And I thought, I seem to remember thinking like, oh, Jesse's going to figure out what happened, that, you know, Walt let her die, and then he's going to go and like do something to his family or something like that. I mean, I got to binge through this, so my questions were answered shortly thereafter, and I was completely wrong about that. I don't know what other people were speculating after this one, but to have a week to think about what might happen after, you know, Jane dies is a lot.
Yeah. The short-sightedness of it all, I mean, that's one thing that kept coming back to me, like the way that she just calls Walt, the way their plan, you know, the whole is New Zealand and Australia and not even knowing, but like, okay, that'll be the thing that'll fix everything up, is just to go there. All of that, you know, again, just to go back to it, the way that Walt has done what he's done, and then how he gets frustrated over and over again that nothing, you know, nothing plays out the way that he expects that it will, and he doesn't get that recognition either. And it's due to his short-sightedness of just like having to deal with the next problem that jumps up and thinking that once he gets that one under control, everything will be smooth sailing. You know, it's all downhill from there, which is just not the way things work, right? So I guess we could probably then get into favorite shots and favorite lines.
All right. So yeah, you first. What was your pick for favorite line?
Oh, for favorite line, that's right. Daddy did that when he's talking to Holly in the room there with the money. I mean, that's just the best way that you can kind of sum up the whole situation, right? This is a child. He can't tell anybody about this. I mean, that's part of his attraction to Jesse, you know, that we were talking about earlier, that weird connection is that Jesse's the one that knows everything, right? So this is a baby. She can't tell anybody what she saw. And just the fact that it is that situation, you know, it's him. That's him by himself with nobody looking and nobody judging him and anything else. And that's what he wants to do, is show this child that he loves, this beautiful little baby, this big stack of money that he can't show anybody else. What about you?
So I went with a family. You can't give up on them. Never. I mean, what else is there? And that's, of course, what Don says to Walt in the bar. So, yeah, I mean, I think this, both of our picks there speak to one of the overarching themes of this episode, this idea of family and the relationship between fathers and their children in particular. And I guess that's, you know, I didn't think about it, but there's two times we hear the word daddy in this episode, and that's when Walt is talking to Holly and says, look what daddy did. And then Jane talking to Donald saying, daddy, please.
You know? Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just one of many ways that they try to connect that thematically.
Absolutely.
What about shot?
This was one where another one of those ones where like the shots were, there was a lot of different things. Like I mentioned Ted, I really liked that one, the reveal on Ted. And I really, liked, you know, some of the other lesser ones, but it does, I thought the lines and just the actual, this is one where the scenes don't stand out from the, like the whole, it's about the whole, yeah, the whole thing. Right. And, everything works together seamlessly is kind of what makes it great. Like the tire bouncing away at the beginning is another one that's pretty memorable and all that. What I picked was the bag shot when he opens the bag and you see from inside, and it's not like the most inspired of those sort of object POV things, you know, but the look on his face, and I just thought that it was one of those things, and it's very similar to the baby monitor scene later in the episode, which is another good one. But like, it's just one of those things that you see because of the fact that that you're seeing it from the bag's point of view instead of from his or the money's point of view, however you want to look at it. You're seeing Walt transform in real time. You know what I mean? Like that's that the person that opens the bag is not someone that you'll ever see again, because the person that is there that develops inside that scene is changed. And so that's what I guess maybe made it stick out for me. Not, like I said, the most inspired of those shots of some of the other ones we've talked about, but I just thought it was, that was an interesting point, because, you know, when he opens it, everything changes from that point on. So what about you?
That's a good pick. And I agree with you on this one. There wasn't a single shot that really stood out to me. And like you, I found that the scenes were, I was thinking more in terms of like, what was my favorite scene of this? Because mm-hmm. there isn't like a single shot that really, there are a couple of artistic ones. There was another one, in the cold open, where they first show him getting to the like motel or wherever he is. And we see him through a perfect circle of broken glass. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was kind of a cool shot, but yeah. You know, it's whatever. It's just a shot. So I was torn between a couple of different things. I ended up picking them at the bar. I love the way that they're framed. I love that conversation. And of course, that's really the turning point for Walt in this episode, where he decides to go back and make this really fateful choice, right? So I just thought it was, you know, had a lot of gravity for that reason. And of course, just the significance, what it means that Donald was sitting there talking to the man who, I mean, you can say like, oh, he didn't really murder her, but he's sitting there talking to the man that could have saved his daughter's life.
It's sort of like the idea of a lie of omission, right? I mean, he murdered her by inaction. I mean, you're not, I guess it's not the same definition. It's not the same, like if it was in a court of law or whatever, it wouldn't be the same as if he put a gun to her head and pulled the trigger. But for our concerns, it's kind of the same, right?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. Yeah, I mean, legal definitions aside, you know, did he go in there with malice aforethought? No, but he could have saved a life and he didn't. And I think, you know, that raises its own ethical questions. So I think that scene is significant for so many different reasons and it stands out. But I also just, I really like the scene that your favorite line comes from, where he's holding Holly in the garage and, you know, pulling back the paper to show her the money. And mm-hmm. I also really like the scene of him just sitting there watching the show on elephants, listening to the baby monitor. So those were the ones that stand out to me. And I mean, of course, the scene at the very end, Bryan Cranston's acting is phenomenal, but definitely not my favorite scene. I think it's a really well-acted scene, and it's Bryan Cranston's favorite scene, and it's something that, you know, he's talked about at length. And it's actually something that he, if you haven't read his autobiography, A Life in Parts, it's actually how he begins his book, is by recounting that particular scene. Do you want me to read a little bit? I'll just read a couple.
Sure, go ahead.
So, yeah, this is how it starts. A Life in Parts, the first part is Walter White. And he says, she stopped coughing. Maybe she'd fallen back asleep. Then suddenly vomit flooded her mouth. She grasped at the sheets. She was choking. I instinctively reached to turn her over, but I stopped myself. Why should I save her? This little junkie, Jane, was threatening to blackmail me, expose my enterprise to the police, destroy everything I had worked for, and wipe out the financial life preserver I was trying to leave my family. The only legacy I could leave them. She gurgled, searching for a gasp of air. Her eyes rolled back in her head. I felt a stab of guilt. God damn it. She's just a girl. Do something. But if I stepped in now, wasn't I just delaying the inevitable? Don't they all at some point end up dead? And poor dumb comatose Jesse, my partner, lying beside her. She's the one who got him on this shit in the first place. She'd kill them both, kill us all, if I stepped in now and played God. So that's how it starts. And it goes on and on and on and on. And he talks about, you know, I think it's something a lot of people, if you're a fan of the show, have heard him talk about, how he actually, when he was acting, envisioned the face of his own daughter, Taylor, for like a split second. So, and then he, you know, talks about how at the end of shooting that scene, like he burst into tears and he was so distraught that like the whole cast and crew came over and they were consoling him, and like Anna Gunn hugged him for like 5 minutes straight. So he's a good storyteller.
Yeah. it's I wanted to say, like, the it's weird because when we started this off, just to bring everything full circle before we go, it's weird because when we talked about the beginning of in our teaser about the, you know, was there something, and you talked about peekaboo, and that's something that I was thinking about in this episode too, right? Like, you feel sympathetic for Jane because of her addiction, and then you think of a character like Spooge, right? Like, Spooge has that same thing, but like, there's not really any sympathy for him, you know what I mean? Like, in that yeah. It's kind of the same. It's kind of like, I mean, I've never heard anyone that said, you know, that watched that episode, because of course their son is involved, you know what I mean, and he's the real victim in that thing. Like, I'm not trying to you know, take away from that at all, but I mean, you know, nobody is looking at them as being like, oh, they're, you know, these people need help, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. you're looking at them like, God, these people are disgusting, you know, look at the way that they live and look at what they do. And so, yeah, it's a pretty big difference in the way that you see Jane here because of the situation. And yeah, I don't know, that's something I thought about when I thought a bit, like, you know, those the thing, who they are is kind of irrelevant. The thing that affects them, and the thing that, you know, this is something that, since this time when this came out, you know, like, it seems like everybody I know now knows somebody who died in the same way. You know, someone, not just someone they heard about, but like someone that they knew, like someone they grew up with, someone that's in their family, someone that's like, you know, that's real, that they lost in this way. And I think that has a lot to do with how difficult this is to watch is for me now, is just because, you know, I've known people and they're gone, they're never coming back. And I know that they were before, and I assume still, when they were in at the height of their addiction, you know, they were still human, you know what I mean? And of course they made a lot of mistakes.
I think that goes back to what you were saying earlier about this idea of othering. And mm-hmm. So we see Walt and Donald both other Jesse and Jane, right? And like, mm-hmm. think of them as somehow less deserving or not part of their concern, right? Like, they only care about the person that's affected. And, you know, it's a interesting point to think about Spooge and his wife, and they are also victims of their addiction. But when we think of how we as a society, and I'm speaking in broader, you know, terms here, sort of sweeping generalizations, but when we think of like, who is deserving of our sympathy and who's deserving of our help and our care and our concern, it's so wrapped up in all of these preconceptions we have. So I think you kind of already touched on this, Pete, but like, when it comes to the Spooges, they are parents. And so it's hard to think of them as victims when there's someone that they are directly putting at risk, right? Where that you think of that child. Whereas in the case of Jane, she's not a parent herself, but we see her in the role of a daughter. Uh-huh. And so we're very much looking at her through that lens, as this is someone's child, and this, she means a great deal to her father. And we see her as that little girl, right? Like, when you know, she has that conversation with him, you know, daddy, please. This is someone's little kid. This is someone's daughter that he loves dearly. So, I mean, I think a lot of that is just how, like, the narrative is framed, and like, mm-hmm. who, you know, we give our sympathy to.
Yeah. And I guess that's sort of what I wanted to come back around to, is just that, you know, all those people are, and it's a terrible thing. You know, like, I think what you were saying is, you know, as a side, the way that we decide who is, I think that, you know, we should be sympathetic for everyone that's, you know, who find themselves in this situation. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of personal responsibility involved, and, you know, just, you know, feeling sympathetic isn't going to change anything for anybody, you know what I mean? But I just think that it's, you know, it's something to think about.
I agree completely. I mean, addicts do terrible things in many cases. They make terrible choices, and they will do some really awful things to feed that addiction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's complicated, but remembering, I think, that it's an illness, I think, is really important, right? So, like, you wouldn't be mad at someone for having cancer. You just wouldn't be mad at mm-hmm. someone for having cancer or having some other serious illness, the same way that we tend to get frustrated with people who are struggling with addiction or other mental illness. And it's, you know, it's a, I think a good way to end this is just to remind everyone, you know, to remember that these are people, these are human beings that are struggling with issues, and doesn't necessarily make them terrible people because they have this addiction.
Yeah. Well said. So if you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow our podcast and set up your notifications so that you'll know when a new episode comes out. And we would really appreciate it if you would rate and review us wherever you listen so that other people can find it. If you want to support us, you can do that on our Patreon, which is patreon.com/growthdecaytransformation.
And you can connect with us on Twitter at BreakingBadGDT or write to us at BreakingBadGDT@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening. Join us next week when we'll be discussing the season 2 finale, ABQ.